From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The media and a herd of international observers have decided that the Palestinian election must be treated as good news, no matter what actually happened on the ground or what actually happens next to Palestinians.
Mahmoud Abbas claims victory in the Palestinian presidential election. We'll talk about the election and how it will affect relations with Israel. Then Sudanese government and southern rebels sign a peace deal ending Africa's longest-running civil war.
It's a historic agreement intended to keep the country intact. It represents to some degree the success of the southern struggle, but it's marred by the ongoing genocide in Darfur.
And we'll take a look at the Salvador option, how the Pentagon's considering using U.S.-led assassination and kidnapping teams in Iraq.
Apparently, the Pentagon is now tacitly acknowledging that they backed the Salvadoran death squads. At the time they denied it, this involved the creation of Army, National Police, Treasury Police, and National Guard units that captured priests, nuns, labor leaders, students, anyone who criticized the Salvadoran armed forces or who criticized the rich. Their bodies were mutilated, tortured, and dumped into ditches. And now, apparently, they're talking about a similar program for Iraq.
Today, we'll look at Palestine, Iraq, Sudan, and Aceh. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the first presidential elections in Palestine since the death of Yasser Arafat, the candidate favored by the U.S. and Israel has declared victory. Mahmoud Abbas won more than 60% of the votes cast, but voter turnout was low, and there were widespread reports of problems at the polls. At least one independent candidate has called for a repeat of the election. After initial results were released, Abbas quickly declared himself the winner and dedicated his victory to the late Yasser Arafat. The runner-up to Abbas, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, won approximately 20% of the vote. He alleged at a news conference that Palestinian security forces and others cast multiple ballots and said that voters were harassed and intimidated by Israeli forces and that some Palestinians were prevented from voting. He said that contrary to media reports, Israel did not remove checkpoints to facilitate the free movement of voters to their election centers. Barghouti also said some 25,000 people who've been held at a checkpoint in Rafah for nearly a month by Israeli forces were unable to return to their hometowns to vote. Still, Dr. Barghouti said his candidacy represented a clear message from Palestinian voters.
We've managed to prove that we are a strong, powerful democratic force. We've managed to prove that we represent a huge majority that has been silent so far, but is not silent anymore, which is not part of the existing polarization between Fatah and Islamic fundamentalism, and that this huge silent majority wants a representative.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Meanwhile, Senator John Kerry is continuing his tour of the Middle East. He met with Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon in Jerusalem, where Kerry said, quote, Israel is our special ally, our special friend. It's a relationship that no one can tear apart.
The security of Israel is the paramount concern. I know the Prime Minister has taken important steps in order to protect that over the course of the last years. The United States, both parties, Republican and Democrat, stand behind Israel in that effort. But we also, all of us, hope for the possibilities of peace in the days ahead. And I look forward to my conversations with the Prime Minister.
John Kerry in Israel. We'll have more on the Palestinian elections in a few minutes. Another high-ranking Iraqi official has been gunned down in Baghdad. Baghdad's deputy police chief and his son were shot dead as they left their family home today. Their car crashed into a house after they had been shot. His assassination came hours after the acting police chief of Samarra was also killed in a drive-by shooting. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera's reporting that U.S. helicopter gunships attacked multiple sites in the northern city of Mosul, and that U.S. and Iraqi forces closed five bridges in the city. In southern Baghdad today, a bomber driving a police car blew himself up at a police station, killing at least three Iraqis. In a separate incident, a number of U.S. soldiers were killed and others injured when an explosive device hit a U.S. military patrol in Abu Ghraib, west of Baghdad. The U.S. military said Monday that a Marine had been killed in action in Al Anbar province in western Iraq. Today's violence comes after another deadly weekend for Iraqi civilians, in which U.S. soldiers may have killed as many as 19 Iraqi civilians in two incidents. On Saturday, 14 Iraqis were killed and five injured after an American warplane dropped a 500-pound bomb on an Iraqi home on a village near Mosul. The U.S. military said it was a mistake. Journalists report rows of freshly dug graves where local people said the dead were buried. Meanwhile, U.S. soldiers who were struck by a roadside bomb allegedly opened fire on Iraqi bystanders on Saturday evening, killing at least three civilians and two policemen. The military says it's investigating both incidents. After an accidental blast killed seven Ukrainian soldiers in Iraq, the country's president-elect, Viktor Yushchenko, said the withdrawing the nation's troops from Iraq will be a priority for him once he takes office. The seven Ukrainian soldiers and one Kazakh soldier died after a bomb they were about to defuse went off accidentally in central Iraq. Some 1,600 Ukrainian troops have been deployed since August 2003. In western Iraq. Prior to Sunday's deaths, Ukraine has lost nine of its troops, with another 20 injured. In the heat of Ukraine's election saga in December, Parliament in Kiev approved a resolution that demanded that the outgoing president, Leonid Kuchma, withdraw Ukrainian soldiers from Iraq. The Sudanese government and southern rebel group signed an agreement Sunday after 3 years of negotiation. The agreement seeks a comprehensive settlement after 21 years of fighting by allowing southern rebels to share power and oil wealth with the Khartoum government. Secretary of State General Colin Powell told an audience of several thousand at the signing ceremony that the agreement is historic and stressed the two sides must uphold their ends of the bargain. He also urged Khartoum to move swiftly toward peace in the western region of Darfur. The deal includes a number of measures that are politically sensitive and may prove difficult to implement. It entitles the southern region to organize an autonomous government and constitution and get a share of Sudan's oil revenue. It calls for the integration of the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Army into the central government's military. It makes John Garang, the U.S.-educated rebel leader, first vice president in a new Sudanese government. It also provides for a referendum after 6 years that would give the South a chance to declare its independence. We'll have more on this story later in the program. A U.S. helicopter with 10 people on board has crashed in a rice paddy as it was trying to land at the Banda Aceh airport while on a tsunami relief operation, injuring at least two U.S. soldiers. The U.S. military suspended helicopter flights for about 2 hours after the crash. Also in Banda Aceh, an earthquake shook buildings and sent people scrambling from their homes early today, but no injuries or damage was reported. Strong aftershocks and security concerns have provided more challenges for aid workers 2 weeks after the tsunami. Aceh has accounted for about two-thirds of the more than 150,000 people known to have died in the disaster. We'll talk more about the situation in Aceh later in the program. Dallas billionaire Mark Cuban has called on President Bush to cancel the lavish inauguration parties planned for later this month and instead donate the money saved, some $40 million, to victims of the Asian tsunami. The owner of the Dallas Mavericks basketball team won't say how much he's given to the disaster victims, but his December 31st proposal on his website has generated controversy and support on the internet. The Presidential Inaugural Committee is raising $30 million to $40 million from private donors and says it doesn't plan to cancel any of the nine inaugural balls on the three so-called candlelight dinners or the three dinners that donors of 250,000 and $100,000 get with the president and first lady. Mark Uban says he voted for President Bush, asked if it was fair to deny Bush supporters a celebration. He replied, quote, "Since when is the level of celebration defined by the amount spent?" And Michael Moore's documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11, has won Best Film at the U.S. People's Choice Awards, voted for by the U.S. public. Mel Gibson's Passion of Christ won Best Drama, despite both films being snubbed so far at U.S. Film Awards in the run-up to February's Oscars. Nominees for the People's Choice Awards were picked by a 6,000-strong Entertainment Weekly magazine panel, and winners were subsequently chosen by 21 million online voters. This is Michael Moore, accepting the award last night.
We live in a great country, and we all love our country very much. And I'm so amazed that you did this, the people of America, that you voted for this film. I can't thank you enough. I'm honored and gratified, and I know that there are many people tonight, mothers and fathers across this country, who have sons and daughters in Iraq. Our prayers are with them, and I dedicate this award to them tonight. And I want to thank most of all the people out there who voted for this. I don't want you to give up. This country is still all of ours, not just right or left, Democrat or Republican. It's all of our country.
Amen.
And I love making movies, and I'll take this as an invitation to make more Fahrenheit 9/11s. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Michael Moore receiving the People's Choice Awards last night in Pasadena, California. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Mahmoud Abbas has claimed victory in the second-ever Palestinian presidential election in occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Though official results will not be released until later today, Abbas, the front-runner and chair of the Palestine Liberation Organization, appears to have received at least 65% of the vote. Addressing hundreds at a rally in the West Bank town of Ramallah, he said, quote, "I present this victory to the soul of Yasser Arafat and present it to our people, to our martyrs, and to our 11,000 prisoners in Israeli jails." International monitors said the ballot appeared to have been fair despite problems with registration, heavy turnout, and the turning away of hundreds of voters from a big Israeli-run polling station in East Jerusalem. The Elections Commission said around 70% of the 1.28 million registered voters cast their ballots. But Agence France-Presse reports only around 10% of the other 700,000 Palestinians who were not on the register but who could still vote by presenting their identity cards did so. That would leave the overall turnout among people eligible to vote below 50%. Pro-democracy activist and independent candidate Dr. Mustafa Barghouti came in second with about 20% of the vote. At a news conference, Barghouti warned that Palestinian security forces and others may have cast multiple ballots.
And so far, till 5 o'clock, or actually till 5:30 maybe, nobody could vote without having the name in the registration lists. After 5:30, the Central Election Commission have informed orally and practiced and allowed voting in several election places without being registered in the list. This means there is a very serious risk that people could vote more than once.
Independent presidential candidate Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Meanwhile, the militant group Hamas says it will work with Mahmoud Abbas despite previously calling for a boycott of the vote. Joining us on the telephone right now is Ali Abu Nima, founder of Electronic Intifada. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Your response to the presidential election?
Well, the reports I've been hearing, and I was talking to people in Palestine all day in Gaza and the West Bank, is that there were significant irregularities in many, many areas. And the impression I think many Palestinians have is that the media, the U.S. government, the herd of international monitors who went over there to certify the victory, decided in advance that the election had to be treated as good news, and they're not interested in what's actually happening to Palestinians, both in the context of the election and the much bigger context of the continued Israeli assault. And the fact that while we're all distracted by this election, Haaretz on Saturday published a lengthy report that while we're all looking at the election, Israel is quietly expanding its settlements throughout the occupied West Bank, with the full approval of the United States, and in particular of Condoleezza Rice, the incoming U.S. Secretary of State. So the false optimism created by this victory for Abbas, all of the pundits who say this is a new dawn, a new opening for peace, really many Palestinians fear this is another setup. So when the inevitable failure brought about by Israeli intransigence occurs, that this will be another opportunity to blame the Palestinians and accuse them of missing an opportunity once again.
And what about what happens next, and particularly Hamas's role, at first calling for a boycott, but then saying they'll support Mahmoud Abbas?
Well, one of the problems is that most Palestinians had not really heard of Mahmoud Abbas until George Bush anointed him the moderate leader, and under Bush's pressure, Abbas was appointed as Palestinian prime minister a while back. And so there was this juggernaut to have Abbas elected in Arafat's place that I think Hamas realizes that this is a political reality. And all of the Palestinian factions, Hamas, as well as all the others, have always put a premium on avoiding any semblance or any emergence of a Palestinian civil war, of Palestinians turning on each other. So I think one of the silver linings of this contest is it showed that Palestinians, unsurprisingly, are capable of political life, a very vigorous ideological and political disagreement without any hint of violence or conflict among each other. And I think that's what Hamas is primarily attempting to demonstrate.
There was some controversy on some of the networks showing the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade holding up Mahmoud Abbas.
Well, this demonstrates the reality that the pundits and the international peace process industry want to remove this election from the context in which it's taking place, under the continued heel of Israel's military tyranny, that for Palestinians whose houses are being demolished every day, whose land is being taken, the U.S. media is paying no attention to this whatsoever. And for many, many Palestinians I talked to who said there's an overwhelming mood that this election makes no difference to them, that they don't see that Mahmoud Abbas or anyone else elected has the power to change the reality that Israel has imposed on them. So in that context, of course, there's going to be resistance, and Abbas can't ignore that. He can't just turn around and appeal to the Israeli and American audience and ignore the context in which his people are living. So he's going to be caught in a trap now where the Israelis and Americans are going to put impossible demands on him, that while Israel continues to confiscate land, continues to build colonies, Abbas's job is going to be to carry out political assassinations of Palestinian resistance leaders on behalf of the occupation, to arrest Palestinians and put them in prison if they express any opposition or resistance to what Israel is doing. And if Abbas fails to do that, he's going to be called a terrorist. Israel is going to use this as an excuse not to enter into any peace talks. And I think it's very significant, this report in Haaretz on Saturday, that is not getting any airing in the U.S., that the U.S. has explicitly approved Israel's plans for construction in 120 settlements across the occupied West Bank, and that the United States government is quietly working with Israel to delineate where this settlement construction is taking place. And Haaretz quotes an Israeli official who says the following to explain why the U.S. is helping Israel with the settlements. He says, "If the U.S. recognizes your claim that the settlement blocks will remain yours forever, why should it make a fuss when you build on your own property?" And according to Peace Now, the Israeli group, which meticulously documents Israeli settlement activity, they're quoted in Haaretz saying, "The main building effort in the Jewish settlements in the West Bank is now focused on the area between the green line and the separation fence, and it is aimed at turning the fence into Israel's permanent border." In other words, what we've been saying all along is coming true, that the apartheid wall, or separation fence, as Israelis call it, is really a land grab. With U.S. support, Israel is rushing to completely colonize the area between the 1967 line and the apartheid wall and create facts on the ground which will leave Palestinians completely isolated in reservations or bantustans. And if the Palestinians want to elect an obedient native leader to rule over them in their reservations, then the Israelis and Americans will support them in doing that. And that's the message that many Palestinians, particularly those in the diaspora, millions of Palestinian refugees who've been absolutely excluded from this election, in contrast to Iraqis and Afghans who are being encouraged to participate, Palestinian refugees have been completely cut off from this process. And it seems that the Americans, the EU, and as I've called it, the peace process industry, see in Abbas someone who will be willing to compromise on fundamental Palestinian rights. And I think they're going to be very disappointed because they're going to find out that simply putting a nice guy in a suit and sitting down with him doesn't change any of the basic realities of the conflict. So all of this optimistic talk of a window of opportunity is going to come to absolutely nothing. And the greater danger, of course, for Palestinians is that they're going to be blamed once again for the impasse. They're going to be told, "Look, we helped you with the election. Everyone supported you. Jimmy Carter came in. Senator Joseph Biden. All these people flocked to the occupied territories to certify the election. And when it fails, because of Israel's intransigence and continued colonization policies and violence, the Palestinians are going to be blamed."
I want to thank you for being with us, Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us. the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the historic agreement signed in Kenya, in the Sudan. And then we'll look at the Salvador option, what the Pentagon is secretly talking about for Iraq today. Investigative journalist Alan Nairn will join us. We'll also talk about the latest situation in Aceh. Who's really holding up the aid? Stay with us. Acid Queen here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, on affiliates, on NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. And those who are hard of hearing and deaf, we also do closed captioning on the TV broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. The Sudanese government and Southern Rebel Group signed a comprehensive peace agreement Sunday, ending Africa's longest-running civil war. Sudan's first vice president, Ali Osman Mohamed Taha, and rebel leader John Garang signed the accord in Kenya's capital of Nairobi, ending a 21-year conflict that's killed an estimated 2 million people, mainly by famine and disease. Under the agreement, the ruling National Congress Party and the Southern Rebels Sudan People's Liberation Movement will form an interim coalition government, decentralize power, share oil revenues, and integrate the military. Starting in July, the South will be autonomous for 6 years and will then vote in a referendum to decide whether to remain a part of the Sudan or become independent. The treaty did not cover a separate conflict in the Western Darfur region, where almost 2 years of fighting have created what the UN calls one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Secretary of State General Colin Powell attended the signing. He urged Khartoum to move quickly toward ending the Darfur crisis, which has left at least 70,000 people dead and 2 million displaced. We turn now to Sally Booker, who is Director of Africa Action. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, and thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about the significance of the Sudan Accord?
Well, it is a historic agreement, and it represents the Southern struggle over so many decades to finally gain a measure of self-determination in this agreement over a period of time. The government is perhaps calculating that it had no choice but to sign this agreement in order to reduce some of its commitments to war in the South because of the ongoing genocide that it's conducting in the western part of the country. It's complicated in the sense that it's hard to celebrate given what's going on in western Sudan. And yet for Southerners and for millions of Sudanese, this really is a historic agreement, an opportunity finally to end what has been the longest running war in the country and for the continent. It's not just the past two decades, but actually since independence in 1956, that this war between the North and the South has been going on. There's only been a decade of peace from the early 70s to the early 80s. And so it's a complicated agreement. It's ambitious. The question is, will it be implemented? Will it meet its timetables? Because if not, the South certainly will secede.
So What about John Garang, the rebel leader, and where he fits into all of this?
Well, John Garang will become a vice president in this new national government, this government of national unity. The Southern people, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement and Liberation Army, which John Garang heads, will become integrated into this new unity government. They have a arrangement favoring the government in certain central administration roles. The South will have its own administration, and they'll share almost evenly responsibility for three regions bordering the South or in between the South and the North. They're going to share oil wealth, and Islamic law is going to be constrained to the North, and in the instance of Khartoum itself, that'll be determined later by an elected assembly. John Garang has made, and the SPLM has made a decision that agreeing to this six-year political solution during which they would try to have autonomy and a unified state would be better than continuing to pursue a violent conflict. And at the end of these 6 years, Southern Sudanese will have an opportunity to vote as to whether they want to secede or whether they want to remain part of a unified Sudan.
And how does this affect what is happening in Darfur?
Well, there are certainly at least two ways to look at it. Some would argue that this agreement augurs well for a peace agreement in Darfur by changing the composition of the central government in Khartoum beginning in 6 months. You have a different government to negotiate with the Darfurian rebels and to end the kind of violence going on in Darfur. That assumes that this agreement will be implemented as planned and that the SPLM will be able to forcefully assert itself on issues in Darfur. On the other hand, I think it can be said that you have to look at the facts on the ground in Darfur, and there's been a buildup of the Sudanese military. Conditions have continued to worsen. The World Food Program has suspended food deliveries. Save the Children has pulled out of the Darfur region. And so the government clearly may be using the diplomacy and peace agreement with the South in order to concentrate its forces and its attentions in Darfur with the intention of defeating this rebellion by continuing to decimate these civilian populations. So it's this contradiction that's at the core of yesterday's signing agreement. And I think it was rather unseemly, in fact, that Secretary Powell was there, the United States having said that there's a genocide occurring in Sudan and that the government is responsible. It seems inappropriate then that they would be supporting that very government in this signing ceremony, even if there's clearly a need for the international community to support this effort to give Southerners self-determination.
Yesterday, watching Colin Powell being questioned on the networks from Kenya, where he was there for the signing agreement, he was asked about why, though, in the past, the U.S. government has talked about what's going on in Darfur as a genocide. Powell has seemed to back off that characterization.
Well, this is the problem with the administration's Sudan policy. Decision to call this a genocide came in response to widespread civic pressure here in the United States from a very eclectic and broad coalition of forces in this country. But, you know, mainly because of the facts on the ground. The State Department undertook this comprehensive study interviewing Sudanese Darfurian refugees in Chad, et cetera, and finally forced to acknowledge that what's occurring does meet the legal definition of the 1948 Convention on Genocide. At the same time, when Powell acknowledged that at the very hearing in the Senate, he said, but no further action is required on the part of the United States. So in the past, during the Clinton administration, you had an effort of denial, to refuse to say genocide for fear that that would require the U.S. to act. Now with the Bush administration, you have a willingness to call it genocide, and at the same time saying, but no action is required, as if this genocide in Africa is somehow acceptable.
We're talking to Sally Booker of Africa Action about the situation in Sudan, both the historic signing of the peace accord between North and South, but also now about the Darfur region. I wanted to move away from Sudan for a minute, though, come back to it. Related to the tsunami, I wanted to look at Somalia for a minute. Somalia next door to Kenya. Kenya did not lose people as a result of the tsunami, but remarkably enough, in Somalia, many people were killed as a result of the wave.
Well, the last official count was, in fact, approaching 300 people killed in Somalia. In fact, one person died in Kenya, 10 in Tanzania, and one in the Seychelles. This was the East African death toll from the tsunami. Some of the countries furthest away from the epicenter of the earthquake. But this is the height of fishing season, and a large number of fishing boats, seaside shelters, equipment, et cetera, were destroyed and washed away when the waves finally reached East Africa. And it's been difficult for these countries also to get a share of the assistance focused on other countries more severely affected. But that's a larger indicator of how difficult it is for African countries to gain sufficient assistance to deal with huge humanitarian crises that the continent faces, both man-made and natural disasters.
And that issue of the vast amount of aid that's going to tsunami victims, mainly, of course, in Asia. What about this issue of where aid goes? We had on one of the heads of Doctors Without Borders, and they had put this controversial message on their website saying, please accept that if you're going to give us money, that money might go to other projects, because they're very concerned that money will be sucked away from other desperate situations in the world. But what about what you think this might mean, for example, for Darfur, where you said, among other organizations, Save Our Children has left, one of the last organizations there. Medicine Without Front, Doctors Without Borders had one, had their people on the ground killed there.
Right. Well, I was certainly encouraged by the statement from Doctors Without Borders. I think it's a very appropriate statement. I think it helps educate people that in a case such as this, there are limits to what individual agencies can do, and that there's a need to pay attention to the rest of the world. In essence, there really are a set of double standards, almost a class system for how the rich countries respond to humanitarian crises in the world. If it's a earthquake, say, in Europe, it's going to get a lot quicker response. Or Eastern Europe after that. Asia, Latin America somehow represent the lower middle class in this class system of humanitarian assistance. In Africa, the underclass. There is a global predisposition to having a higher level of tolerance for suffering in Africa, almost an assumption that there's going to be a certain level of suffering in Africa. And so the annual appeals for humanitarian assistance that come out from the United Nations to cover the Democratic Republic of Congo or refugee and displaced people needs in Cote d'Ivoire or Darfur largely go unmet year after year. And the UN has been calling rich countries stingy because of this annual reality, not commenting on the outpouring to the tsunami victims, which in part is driven also by the saturation media coverage. And that, in turn, to some degree, is also pulled by the fact that there are large numbers of European tourists in the Indian Ocean area that was most affected. So all these things tie together to have the same effect, that Africa's crises are always given the least attention and the least amount of resources.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Sally Booker of Africa Action.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk about an expose in Newsweek magazine saying that the Pentagon is secretly weighing whether to deploy the Salvador option in Iraq, U.S.-trained assassination and kidnapping squads. We'll also talk about what is happening, the political situation in Aceh around the tsunami. We'll be joined by investigative journalist Alan Nairn. Stay with us.
I'm going to tell you what. number of things. But you really only have to remember two words. Government's a lie. Government's a lie. I mean, not just the American government.
¿Será que no quiere pensar en lo que pudiera pasar si la mayoría en la nación empieza a gritar revolución? Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente.
Los Mucosos, Señor Presidente, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As violence in Iraq continues into 2005, the U.S. government is considering setting up assassination squads to target leaders of the Iraqi resistance. Newsweek magazine is reporting in this week's issue that the Pentagon is drawing up possible proposals to send special forces teams to advise, support, and train hand-picked Iraqi squads to target Sunni rebels. Within the Pentagon, the tactic is called the Salvador option, after the strategy that was secretly employed by Ronald Reagan's administration to combat the guerrilla insurgency in Salvador in the early 80s. The U.S.-backed death squads hunted down and assassinated rebel leaders and their supporters. The current U.S. ambassador in Iraq is John Negroponte. As ambassador to Honduras, Negroponte played a key role in coordinating U.S. covert aid to the Contras, who targeted civilians in Nicaragua. Negroponte is also accused of shoring up a CIA-backed death squad in Honduras. The Newsweek report says the Iraqi squads would most likely be made up of Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and Shia militiamen and could even operate across the Syrian border. It's also still unclear whether Pentagon or the CIA would take responsibility for the squads. Well, right now we're joined by journalist and activist Alan Nairn. 20 years ago, in 1984, his article in the Progressive magazine about the CIA's backing of the El Salvador death squads led to an investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee into CIA and military support for the Salvadoran death squads. The Intelligence Committee came out with a 400-page report, which never saw the light of day. I believe there were only two copies made. But let's ask Alan Nairn. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what this Salvador option means, hearing about the Newsweek report that they might employ it in Iraq?
Well, Newsweek said that they described the Salvador option as the targeting of combatants and their sympathizers, and the key word is sympathizers. In El Salvador, and not just Salvador, but about three dozen other countries, the U.S. government, in an integrated effort involving the CIA, the Pentagon, and the State Department, backed the creation of military units that targeted civilian activists. In Salvador, I interviewed many of the officers involved in running these squads. For example, General Chely Medrano, who was on the CIA payroll, described how they picked their targets. He said they targeted people who speak, and these are his words, against Yankee imperialism, against the oligarchy, against military men. These people are traitors to the country. What can the troops do? When they find them, they kill them. Actually, they didn't always kill them. Often they brought them to the headquarters of the Treasury Police, the National Guard, the Army, and they tortured them for days. One former member of the Salvadoran Treasury Police, Rene Hurtado, described a course that was given at Army General Staff Headquarters where American officers gave instruction in techniques including electroshock torture. Hurtado himself said he conducted such torture He said, these are his words, you put wires on the prisoner's vital parts. You place the wires between the prisoner's teeth, on the penis, in the vagina. The prisoners feel it more if their feet are in the water and they're seated on iron, so the blow is stronger. When it's over, you just throw him in the alleys with a sign saying, Mano Blanca, Esa, Maximiliano Hernandez Brigade. These are the names of the Salvadoran death squads. I was given a chance to see the archives of the Salvadoran National Police, the intelligence archives, and you could see they had files marked union, student, religious. They showed me a card file which included surveillance reports on activists who had traveled to other countries. These surveillance reports were given to them, according to the captain who was giving me this tour, by the CIA. The whole filing system was set up for them by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Medrano was at one point brought to the Oval Office in the White House and presented a silver medal by President Lyndon Johnson for, and he showed me the medal, inscribed on the medal, for exceptionally meritorious service. This program actually began not just under Reagan, but during the John F. Kennedy administration. It encompassed all of Latin America, or all of the dictatorships of Latin America that were being backed by the U.S. In the Central American region, it included Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Honduras. A special teletype system, which at that time was the top technology, was set up for exchanging information among the intelligence services of the various participant countries, where information would be passed back and forth about, for example, labor leaders who would travel from one country to another for conferences. And then on their return, they would be picked up, tortured, and assassinated. Something on the order of 75,000 Salvadoran civilians were killed by the Salvadoran military, most of them during the 70s, and the majority of these were targeted by these death squad-type forces. So one point is these were not combatants who were being killed. These were not armed guerrillas. They were sometimes engaged by the Salvadoran military in combat, but the death squad operations, which the Pentagon, according to Newsweek, is now talking about using for Iraq, these went after civilians.
We're talking to Alan Nairn. You talk about General Medrano, who is known as the father of these death squads trained by the United States in El Salvador, again, this 20 years ago. And I'm looking at a full-page ad that the Progressive took out in the Washington Post behind the death squads, an exclusive report on the U.S. role in Salvador's official terror. Can you talk about the effect of this and how this information was made known?
Well, based on some of those interviews I just described and also U.S. internal U.S. documents, I did that article for The Progressive. They published it, I think it was May of 84, and it was almost completely ignored by the corporate press. There was no notice whatsoever. So then the Progressive went out and raised money from various donors, and they were able to buy a full-page ad in The Washington Post where they reprinted about a third of the article. This got some attention in Washington. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee then asked me to come in and meet with them. So I did in a closed session, and was questioned by dozens of the Intelligence Committee staff for about 3 or 4 hours about what the U.S. had done to back and create the Salvadoran death squads. Now, this was a bit curious, since they were the ones who had security clearance, who had access to the CIA and Pentagon files. They were the ones who worked with them, indeed funded them. But they were asking me, I think in part maybe to try to find out how much I knew. I mean, what I knew was what I had printed in the magazine. But I was trying to spur them to investigate. And they did. They then launched an investigation where they say they examined more than a million internal documents. They produced a 400-page report, which was heavily classified. They told me that only two copies of the report were produced, one in a sealed room that only kept on Capitol Hill, which only the senators on the committee could read, and another at the CIA headquarters. A public report was released which said nothing. Some of the senators told me that the classified, they told me a little bit about the classified report. They said that they had verified that, in fact, yes, the U.S. had set up these death squads in Salvador, and also that U.S. personnel had sometimes been on the premises during torture sessions and had supplied questions for the prisoners being tortured.
So this was back in 1984, 1985, when this was coming back, coming out. Did it surprise you that the Pentagon is actually calling this proposal, according to Newsweek, to train, it's not clear if it's CIA-backed, Pentagon-backed assassination and kidnapping squads in El Salvador, that they're calling it the Salvador option? Have they ever acknowledged it publicly?
Well, it sounds no, they never acknowledged it publicly. That Senate report was classified. But now it sounds like in an offhand way. It's almost, I mean, it sounds as if they're almost talking about it even in a almost a joking way. I mean, the Salvador, oh, yeah, we'll do to them what we did to Salvador. I mean, it's an astonishing admission. But I think now that this is on the record, immediately the Senate Intelligence Committee should release their classified report of 84, and there should be a demand that the Pentagon and the CIA release all internal documents they have about the Salvador option and similar activities in Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Salvador, also There are dozens of other countries around the world where this has happened. Recently, we had the revelations about General Pinochet and his bank account at the Riggs Bank in Washington. He was paid millions by the U.S. as a very similar intelligence exchange system and assassination system was being set up in the southern cone countries. This admission should be pursued, and the U.S. officials who participated in creating units that kill civilians should be prosecuted for murder. We have to enforce the murder laws.
The nuns, the American nuns that's referred to in the Newsweek piece that were killed in El Salvador, Alan, can you give some background as the Pentagon apparently weighs this option of the Salvador option in Iraq?
Well, they were killed by the National Salvadoran National Guard. They were pulled from their vehicle, raped, shot, dumped into a ditch. And this was a typical Salvadoran death squad operation. This one got a lot of attention in the press in the U.S. because the victims were American. Although at the time, U.S. officials actually tried to excuse it. Alexander Haig, I believe it was Alexander Haig, spoke publicly about there being an exchange of gunfire, which implied that these were pistol-packing nuns who had to be brought down in combat by the Salvadoran forces. Jean Kirkpatrick actually said, well, these weren't real nuns, her suggestion being that they were activists, and that this somehow, she seemed to be suggesting that this somehow legitimized their targeting. And in fact, that was the principle behind these death squad operations.
And then the Jesuits who were killed in El Salvador, not to mention the Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero.
Archbishop Romero was killed as part of, according to later investigations, was killed by an offshoot of the operation of Roberto Daubison, who ran the Arena Party, which was one of the death squad operations, one of the smaller ones, actually. The larger came from the regular Salvadoran armed forces and police. He also had U.S. backing. In fact, Daubison launched his career as a major figure in Salvador by going on TV and making a speech. And he had a video role as he spoke with an illustrated death list of union people and religious figures and others who he said should be killed as traitors to the country. And the data for this list were supplied to him by American intelligence, again, according to the officers there I interviewed.
Now, one link between Salvador 20 years ago and today in Iraq is the former U.S. ambassador to Honduras, John Negroponte, who's the current ambassador to Iraq. And I also want to get to Aceh and talk about the latest that's happening there. But in just a minute, if you could sum up that link.
Well, Negroponte was one of the people who ran the Contra operation, the invasion against Nicaragua, which the World Court later ruled to be an act of aggression by the Contras, which were created and funded by the U.S. Government. He also oversaw the military backing for Battalion 316, which was a Honduran military death squad, which specialized in torture and assassination.
And so what it means that he is in charge of Iraq right now. Do you think he is a part of designing this, quote, Salvador option?
Maybe not. They probably have other people who are specialists in that. He's probably handling the economic side of it. But if there are political apologies to be done, Negroponte may handle it. The thing is that these programs, which back the killing of foreign civilians, it's a regular part of U.S. policy. It's ingrained in U.S. policy in dozens upon dozens of countries. In Indonesia, for example, which we're going to talk about in a minute, where the tsunami hit, the Kopassus, the Red Berets, which there specialize in torture and assassination, they have been trained by U.S. Green Berets in things like urban warfare. This is a longstanding policy, and it's nothing new.
Now, we only have 3 minutes left, and I do want to turn now to Aceh and the latest situation there. The Indonesian military working together with the U.S. military, saying that they are helping to distribute aid. Colin Powell saying that they're working ever closer, providing support now for the Indonesian military. The U.S. has been prevented from doing that for a number of years now because of the brutality of the Indonesian military. Can you talk about the latest in Aceh?
Well, Colin Powell announced that the U.S. would be supplying spare parts for C-130 transport planes, ostensibly to help with the relief effort, Indonesian military transport planes. Within days of Powell making this announcement, it came out that the Indonesian military, which had previously used these planes to transport the goods looted from East Timor as they were destroying East Timor in 1999, to take thousands of Timorese civilian prisoners out after the 99 campaign of slaughter in Timor, which previously had been used to drop paratroops over Aceh, were now used just in the past week to bring members of two bin Laden-affiliated Indonesian groups, the FPI and the MMI, the Islamic Defenders Front and the Islamic Mujahideen Council. They flew them up to Aceh to help in the ostensibly to help in the relief effort. People from these groups were created. The FPI was in part created by the Indonesian armed forces, and the MMI has received backing from Indonesian military intelligence at various points. The MMI includes the Laskar Jihad, a group that went into the Moluccas and helped spur sectarian fighting between Muslim and Christian peasants, Muslim and Christian militias, in which thousands were killed. This was done to create chaos, which the Indonesian military could then take advantage of. And these groups are openly connected to bin Laden and espouse that ideology.
Wait, and you're saying the Indonesian military has brought them into Aceh now, actually flown them in?
They just brought them into Aceh. Some of them are walking around with bin Laden T-shirts. They go up to foreign reporters and present themselves as Achenese, even though they aren't. And then James Kelly of the U.S. State Department just said there's worry that such militants might attack U.S. troops. Simultaneously, Powell is announcing the U.S. is going to aid the Indonesian military, one of the rationales being the Indonesian military is needed to fight such bin Laden-style militants.
So the Indonesian military brought them in as a way to galvanize support for the Indonesian military?
Apparently so. They've used similar tactics before. And it also seems to be a way of terrorizing the Achenese population.
We only have 20 seconds. Are they going to try to say they are the rebels that are in Aceh?
Possibly. Previously, they tried to bring the Laskar Jihad, who helped do the killing in the Moluccas, into Aceh. The Achenese pro-independence rebels threatened to kill them all, and those groups fled. But the Indonesian military, they'll try anything. And the American Pentagon, Admiral Fargo, was on Capitol Hill last week lobbying for restoration of military training for Indonesia. If people want to help grassroots groups on the ground in Aceh,
we have 5 seconds.
They can go to the etan.org website and back groups like the People's Crisis Center, which are doing civilian relief for the people who've been devastated by the tsunami.
Well, Alan Nairn, investigative reporter and activist, just recently back from Indonesia and Aceh, also the author of the piece in the Progressive magazine 20 years ago, Behind the Death Squads, an exclusive report on the U.S. role in Salvador's official terror. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.